This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. The program features two women today, and their poetry is very different. Yvette Nicer Moreno and Terry Ellen Cross. Yvette, let's hear a poem.
The first poem I'm going to read is one that I wrote after 9/11. And if you recall, the tragedy of 9/11 happened just before the Jewish high holidays, which always come up in the early fall. And it happened to be that I was at synagogue at a Yom Kippur service, and this poem kind of came to me as I was sitting there. And it mentions a candelabra, which is not the Hanukkah menorah, but a seven-branched menorah that was lit at that service, and also mentioned the shofar, which is the traditional ram's horn, which is blown on the high holy days. Now anything can quicken your heartbeat. The rush of a train, a dog's bark, the sudden rustle of leaves as a bird flies out of a bush, night's utter silence, the dark rooms and vulnerability of windows. Still, on the holiest day of the year, wax drips down a candelabra from seven burning candles, solidifying in spontaneous patterns around the brass of each branch, one drop layered upon another. And the flames, those minute glimpses into the soul, flutter like stars before they extinguish, as if closing from within. After the shofar blows, after the prayers for the unfound dead, trapped under the smoldering remains of our once unwavering landscape, something is left. The elegant sweepings of wax, a testament to the fire they once contained, to the permanence of a pure, ragged beauty.
Beautiful. That was Yvette Nicer Moreno. Yvette, I was wondering, there's no epigraph at that beginning, is there?
No.
You know, I would have liked to know that was after September 11th. Is that terrible to say? Because it does cast a whole different dimension to the poem. I read it without knowing that was why your heart was beating quickly.
Well, to be honest, I guess when I first wrote it, and actually I should say this poem was actually published in an anthology of poems written after September 11th, so it's certainly going to be known that way. When I first wrote it, I think I had put a little epigraph saying after 9/11 or something like that, and I sent it to a friend of mine, a poet, a former professor, and he said, "This is a good poem except for the part about 9/11.
You can't. So, can't please everyone.
So I took it off, but I hope that the images of the people trapped under the smoldering remains of our once unwavering landscape would bring up memory.
More than 9/11. Actually, it makes it ubiquitous. More, it could be all perishing, all war. And yes, you're very involved with writing about war and cultural change. Here she is. She is originally from New Jersey. Whereabouts?
Montclair.
And I'm from Trenton. She received her undergraduate in English and Middle East Studies from Tufts and her master's in fine arts from the University of North Carolina. And I think this is very important because your work for organizations promoting peace and conflict resolutions in the Middle East folds right into your translations, which are Hebrew, Arabic, Spanish. We will get a little bit of each of that today, and I'm very, very honored to have you on the air for the good work you're doing and for the good poetry you're writing.
Thank you very much.
Let's have another.
Okay, would you like a translation?
I'd like that. Yeah, who are we going to hear?
This is a translation of a poem by Pablo Neruda. He is my all-time favorite poet. For those who don't know, Pablo Neruda was a Nobel Prize-winning poet in the 20th century from Chile. Obviously, the original is in Spanish. I'll start with the English.
Okay.
And I should say, before I read it, this is one of his 100 love sonnets. It was from a book that he wrote for his third wife, Matilda, a book of 100 love sonnets. And he felt that Matilda was his true partner in life that he had been looking for all his life.
Did you translate it?
Yes, this is my translation. Yeah. So the poem begins, if you can, with the image of the previous part of his life being a period of confusion with his other wives, his other lovers, and his life came to a clear direction when he met Matilda. From so much love, my life was tinged with violet, and I tumbled from limb to limb like a blind bird until arriving at your window, my friend. You sensed a heartbroken murmuring, and there, from the darkness, I rose to your breast, without being, without knowing, up to the Tower of Wheat. I emerged ready to live between your hands. I rose from the sea to your joyfulness. No one can measure what I owe you, love. It is luminous. What I owe you is like a root birthed in Araucania, what I owe you, my love. It is utterly starborn, all that I owe you. What I owe you is like the well of a wilderness, where time once tempered errant flashes of lightning.
Beautiful. I would like to hear now you went from the Spanish to English. So
right.
Those are your words.
Those are my words. I always go from Spanish to English.
Why is that?
Because English is my native language, and that's the language in which I write poetry.
Let's hear how he said it.
Okay. Well, nobody can say it the way Pablo Neruda says it. to me, he's a god of poetry. De tanto amor, mi vida se tiñó de violeta. Y fui de rumbo en rumbo como las aves ciegas, hasta llegar a tu ventana, amiga mía. Tú sentiste un rumor de corazón quebrado, y allí, de las tinieblas, me levanté a tu pecho. Sin ser y sin saber, fui a la torre del trigo. Surgí para vivir entre tus manos. Me levanté del mar a tu alegría. Nadie puede contar lo que te debo. Es lúcido lo que te debo, amor. Y es como una raíz natal de Araucanía, lo que te debo, amada. Es sin duda estrellado todo lo que te debo. Lo que te debo es como el pozo de una zona silvestre en donde guardó el tiempo relámpagos errantes.
This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and we're listening to Yvette Nicer Moreno. I think he'd like that. I think he'd like the way you read that. Because it's obvious what he means to you. You're working on another project of translation this year. What is it?
I've actually just finished the project, finally, after about 3 years of working on it. I translated a book of poetry by the Argentinian poet Luis Alberto Ambrogio. Again, going from Spanish to English. He writes in Spanish only. And he's an Argentinian poet who has lived here in the United States for about 40 years. So, interestingly, he almost never writes in English, even though he's much more fluent in English than I am in Spanish, for example. But
Did you find him, or how did he find you?
We met at a poetry reading. In fact, it was a fateful poetry reading for me. I happened to be there because I mistakenly believed that it was the year of the centennial of Pablo Neruda's birth, which was 2004. I mistakenly believed that it was a poetry marathon of Pablo Neruda's poems that was open to the public, and I thought everybody was going to be reading poems by Neruda. And I was so excited, and I went with some of my translations of Neruda, which I was already working on, and it turned out that it was just a general poetry marathon of Spanish poetry. It was dedicated to Neruda, but in fact, it was for all poets. So I was the only one reading Neruda. But anyway, I believe, the translation that I just read to you and a couple of others. And Luis Alberto was one of the featured readers there. And I enjoyed his poetry. And afterwards, he approached me and asked whether I would be interested in translating his work.
Let's hear a little bit of that. And then I do want to explore the translator's mind. So give us a little bit of him.
Okay.
Do you want to do it? Which language would you like first? What feels more comfortable?
Either way.
Okay. Let's have Spanish first.
Okay. El regalo del tío. Difícil hacer de soldado. Irse de casa sin ganas. Borrar la mancha de sangre en las botas. Morir de vez en cuando. Entre los soldaditos de plomo, no se fabrica de plomo la muerte. Tampoco existen figurines de niños que lloren terror en sus caras. ¿Cómo se puede entonces, tío, jugar seriamente a la guerra? You ready for the English?
Yeah, I am.
Okay. Uncle's gift. It's hard to play soldier, to go hunting against your will, to wipe bloodstains off your boots and die from time to time. Among the little lead soldiers, there is no death made of lead, nor are there figures of children with tears of terror in their faces. So, Uncle, how can anybody seriously play war?
What do you think you have in your character that makes you want to translate other people? What is in your personal makeup that wants you to be the woman behind the words? They get sometimes no credit.
Right. we're working on that. We, the translators of the world, are working on that. And certainly my name always appears on these translations. But
What do you think there is about you, emotionally and spiritually, that makes you love to make another poet shine, to get into their work and understand it?
I never thought about it emotionally, per se. For me, it's very natural to translate poetry because my two greatest loves intellectually are poetry and languages. I love studying languages. I love learning about foreign languages. I love talking about them. And to put the two together is very natural. Poetry, of course, itself is a form of language, a special form of language. And so to me, all poets love language. They love words. And I am one of them. So
I should let everyone know that you teach literary translations at the Writers' Center in Bethesda. Is that ongoing now?
I have a course coming up starting in October. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, so.
How do you teach people? Do they have to have, first of all, they have to have knowledge of the other language, right?
Sure.
That's a prerequisite.
Yes.
But what do you teach? How, other than the literal translation, what's the next level?
We work on the nuances of poetry. And I have worked with teaching prose, literary prose translation also, which involves many of the same elements, although others are distinct. So you need to work on choosing the words that sound poetic and and bringing into English words that we don't have in English. For example, in the poem that I read from Neruda, there's a word, estrellado. It's a word we do have in English. In this particular context, it means starry, full of stars. But starry is not such a quite poetic word in English as estrellado in Spanish. It has many syllables. It's very evocative. Starry in this particular poem fell flat for me. So sometimes you have to invent words. And sometimes you have to recast an entire stanza in order to create a sentence structure that makes sense.
What an alchemist you are. What a magic person you are. She has her own book, which is Seeking Publications, which is Fields of Vision. And I think that the Spanish book that you are translating, which is scheduled to be published, is called Difficult Beauty,
yes.
Selected Poems. And when will that be out? In 2008?
Hopefully in 2008.
Mm-hmm. Your own poems have been in many anthologies throughout the country, Virginia Quarterly Review, International Poetry Review, The Potomac Review, Poetic Voices Without Borders, and many more. Your critical work on Palestinian and Israeli poetry has been published. Now, I find that really interesting. Translations of Palestinian and Israeli poetry. Do your politics make you neutral in that regard? I mean, do you have equal love on either side?
I do.
Because, yeah.
I do.
Poetry transcends, right?
Although, politically, I'm also, I believe, neutral, which is rare for a Jewish poet, or Jewish person, I should say. Yes.
Let us hear some more poetry. Yvette Nicer Moreno.
Shall I read one more from Luis Alberto's book?
Yeah, they seem tantalizing, so let's have one.
Okay.
We'll do the English.
Okay, I'll read it in English. This one is from a book called El Testigo Se Desnuda, which was published in 2002, and this will appear in Difficult Beauty, hopefully coming out next year. Makeup. I saw his face touched up, peaceful and less wrinkled, immune to what was happening around him. solemn in all respects, without tears or the difficult beauty that in life had characterized his visage. What happened to the lines on the old man's face that had expressed every fury and joy, I wondered, beneath the austere silence in which a thousand questions were stifled by flowers. Is it worth leaving this life with the false pallor of a mask? Why did they take from our friend, with a makeover that fools no one, the beauty that we all knew, with its wrinkles, smiles, suffering, talking to us, without touch-ups, face to face?
Now let us go into one of your own poems, because I want to hear if there's any breath or any essence that I feel I can identify. This is Yvette. Now she's going to read one of her own. This is from Fields of Vision.
Yes, from Fields of Vision. If you'll forgive me for reading another poem that relates to death. It's one of my subjects.
Poets have made a meal on that for many a year. The mother of beauty, right?
This is a poem that I wrote shortly after my father's death, and I just happened to be visiting Walden Pond in Massachusetts with my husband, and it happened to be a very foggy evening. Before dusk, the pond in fog. I couldn't tell where water ended and sky began. I was hoping, if I stared hard enough, your face would emerge from the blurred darkness, like coming up from the basement, wiping your sweat with a towel. But the only image that solidified was a line of trees on each side of the pond, angling in toward where the horizon should be. Pines, I think. Hard to tell in that dusk, where they were no more than tall black shapes, slightly darker than the slate sky. Did entering death resemble this? Mist swirling so you couldn't see where you were going, while behind you lay everywhere you'd ever been. Across my field of vision flew six black spots in a line. In the darkening fog, I knew them as birds, only because they were in the air, before landing one by one on what must have been water.
I love the perspective in that poem. I really like so much the geography of it. And when I read it on the page, I found it remarkable. The weather is the same. You found the right language for the weather and the tone, the right words that fit. And I think that might be the gift you got from your years of translating, that you have to find the exact precise word that for gray and the mist. You can't just fudge, you know, and the translator can't miss a beat.
That's interesting that you said that. I might have thought that it was the other way around. In other words, that if my translations ring in English, if they have a richness in English, that that should be because I write that way in my own poetry. In other words, for me, writing my original poetry came first, and I started translating later. So my style of poetry was, I mean, always developing, of course, but was more or less established already.
I think it goes both ways.
Mm-hmm, I agree.
I really think you're enriched by your translations, mm-hmm. and that has to have given another tone to your own work. I mean, you just can't, there has to be some divine equity in this world where you get paid back a little.
Yes, definitely. There's definitely an interplay, definitely. And I think that's why, if I may give a plug for translation, I believe that most great poets, if you read their biographies, will find that they have translated in addition to writing their own poetry. Most of the great poets have translated either classical works or their favorite poets, and almost always, if you'll notice, into their own native language. For example, Pablo Neruda, who is my favorite, I believe he translated Whitman into Spanish. I could come up with countless
yes.
examples, and I always use a famous quote by, the poet's name is slipping me right now, a wonderful American woman poet.
Give us the quote.
Jane Kenyon, who said that every poet should try their hand at translation because it's important in the development of the poetic art.
Well, I agree, but I'm not good at it. I mean, I've done Persian, Bulgarian, and many others, and the flat Bulgarian that was given to me was I thought was good. I didn't want to meddle with it.
The literal translation you were
given? Yeah, I thought it was pretty good. And because Bulgarians are kind of no-nonsense writers anyway. And I just didn't feel like I needed to mess with it. But I do also wonder how good what those poets who translate, I mean, some of them couldn't know other languages.
That's
so they have a literal given to them, and they do touch it with their golden hands. But you're going full force. I mean, you start with pebbles and make buildings out of them.
I love it. And I mean, for anyone who is like me, a student of language, of any foreign language, and for that matter, a student of my own language, but it's the joy of it is going deep into the language and finding new words, finding new meanings for words that you didn't know, and then coming back to your own language, in my case English, and then again working with words and trying to come up with digging around, and I spend a lot of time with the thesaurus when I'm translating, with the English thesaurus. Roger is my favorite, and
I like
looking for new
myself,
words.
Roger's. Well, your translations are. Translators are just certain kind of people. You're basically scholars. You are basically a scholar. It's all research. And you have to be patient, enormously patient. And you have to be humble. Now, are you all those things, Yvette?
That's interesting. I'm nodding and thinking as you're saying those things. Yes. You have to be humble and confident at the same time. Because, especially if you take a poet like Pablo Neruda, and he was not his poetry is not humble. His poetry is not mild. His poetry is bold. And so you have to be bold in translating it. Otherwise, the translation doesn't work. Otherwise, it doesn't sound like Neruda.
So you have various identities. You do. You must have to adapt to psychologically to the poet that you're translating. So the one you're doing now, the Argentinian, do you think that you're compatible?
Yes. Yes and no. I'm not compatible with every poem. He has a very wide range of styles in his poetry, a wide range of voices. And some of those voices fit naturally for me, and others is quite a stretch. And I took it as a challenge to try to stretch to the voices that didn't feel like mine. In particular, he has a very male voice in some of his poems. He does write some erotic poetry and some poems with sexual nuances, and it felt very unnatural for me to take on a male sexual voice in a poem. So, but he encouraged me to do it, and I did. Not many of the erotic poems appear in our book, but I did translate a few of them, and it's I get one of the other joys of translation is taking on a new voice. It forcing yourself to write in something that you wouldn't normally write, something that may not be natural to you.
When do you do this? You have two small children.
I put them in daycare.
So you work every day?
Yes, I can't. Well, not every single day. No, for several years now since my son was born, I've been working 3 days a week, and the other days I spend with the kids. But I am not able to focus on poetry when I'm with the kids. It feels very unpoetic to me, being a mom of toddlers and young children. When I first had my first child, my son, people would say to me, "So have you been writing about the baby? You know, has your poetry been developing with the baby and childbirth and all that?" And I would say, "No, are you kidding? I mean, for me, that was, you know, changing diapers and all of that. It was so complete, you know, my baby spit up. It was like my days with the baby were so full of all of this
but
grossness."
But wait a minute. I'm going to call you on this.
Yeah.
From the vomit, from the diapers. We do have a poem on your childbirth experience.
You want to hear that one?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because there were some crystal moments.
Yes.
And you have saved them.
Yes.
So let's have it.
This one I actually wrote for my daughter. This is my second child. She was born last year. Spark. From love, from a spark of desire, an egg nestles in the lining of my womb. How does a tiny mass of cells become this heartbreaking creature, a a full-bodied human, her four-chambered heart beating at the side of my womb when I lie down and when I rise up. A living baby that blooms from my body to breathe on my skin, to be lulled by the familiar thump of my heart.
Now we'll hear a final poem.
A final poem.
Not final, just for our 30 minutes.
Nothing is final, right? All right, well, you asked me to save my favorite poem for last. And while I don't have one favorite, this is one that, one of my favorites, and it would certainly be my husband's favorite, and so in his honor I will read it. He loves poems that are about him. From the shadows of this hidden town, the buried pulse of front porches and empty rockers, the trunks of live oaks whose soft leaves canopy our streets. From wisteria coiled like wire around these pines, dangling chains of tiny purple blossoms, from the absolute mystery of seeds multiplying in soil, from under the weight of fishing piers, wooden columns riveted by water's burden, from the tide lashing upward, all echo and spray, from the frail lines trailing their hooks along the ocean's spume, from the indented cradle between two waves, from a lizard's darting glance, the slow creak of the drawbridge opening its jaws to the ebbing sun, through the yellow skim coating the river, the traces of moon over my backyard, the freight train's midnight wail, the narrow space between two notes of a wind chime, the long swallow of language. Did you travel through all this to love me?
I find that women do not write as many love poems to their mates as men do. So thank you for that contribution and all your contributions. That was Yvette Nicer Moreno, and I am Grace Cavalieri. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. Stay with us. We'll be right back. We're back, and this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and with me is Terry Ellen Cross, and she's here with an opening poem.
This is called Morning When a Dream Lingers, and it has an epigraph by a now-defunct band called Frou Frou. Music is worthless unless it can make a complete stranger break down and cry from the dumbing down of love. Paint the sky slate gray. Streak cornflower blue with rain, layer wisps of a singer's voice, yearning, aching, and familiar. Make this a scene stolen and framed from some forgettable film, its protagonist beautiful, unobserved, and broken. Give her kinky hair, make her brown, and this will be a film you've never seen. Here, touch is not a physical sensation, but analytical. Wistful, hollow, like a word, like a vestige. Ask yourself, how long do you wait to get out of bed? When do you rein in the ghost? Silence them, get up, live.
Terry Ellen Cross first started out in journalism from Ohio State, and then she got her Master's of Fine Arts in Poetry from American University. She was a Ford Foundation Fellow, a Cave Canem Fellow, and recently attended the Soul Mountain Writers Retreat, which we'll find out about. When I read that poem on the page, Terry, I said, what did she leave out of this poem? When I read your work, it feels as if there's a lot going on under the surface. How do you decide what to say?
It's all goes back to that first rush of blood, of vision, of language that happens when the poem begins to kind of coalesce in my mind. And it takes a lot of work with this poem. You know, I went through with a lot of different versions of it, trying to figure out, well, how do I get across what it is I really want to get across in this poem. But it takes a lot of standing, looking at it, and then standing back and trying to give it time to breathe and live on its own. And then maybe coming back to it for me to say, okay, well, this won't work. This works better. This doesn't work, you know, and go and so forth.
But there's also something intrinsic in your personality that made you draw the essence or the breath of the dream, the lingering dream, whereas I would have written the dream.
Mm-hmm.
So that there is something in the way that you distill poetry that makes your voice different from another voice. And I mean, we're all inimitable. But I just actually would have said, and then the train went through the dream. So I'm finding out more and more about you. And let's hear another poem.
Sure. This is for my late father-in-law. And it's called After Earl Came Home. He lies on the eve of his death, calling out to the only woman in the house, his new daughter-in-law. He gestures toward a ripe fruit basket, a consoling gift to his sons, yet in grief. Her hand wavers, anxious to please, unsure if the duty is right. She selects the reddest of apples. Its firm body cups itself into her palm. Silently, she slips to the kitchen. Intense, she washes away pesticides, polish, only to peel the fruit. Red wrapping curls reveal the white interior. Now the real work begins as she cores the fruit, steadies herself to slice the crescents smoothly, clean curves a dying artist can appreciate. She sneaks back to his side, careful to avoid her brother-in-law, a licensed nurse, sure to disapprove of the apple's intended recipient. Complicit, illicit, she slides the nude pieces to his trembling hands, thinking this secret she can keep. How grateful his lips are for this last taste of Eden.
That's Terry Ellen Cross. I always knew you were subversive. Illicit, complicit. We know the poet will do what she feels is the best thing to do it. The poem turns in a certain place. If I were teaching a class, I'd say, now, where does that poem turn? And I don't know if the poet always knows, but I love where you go, now the real work begins.
In a lot of ways for me, that is just where the poem does begin to make the turn, because there's so much that you build up. There's so much that you create that's the backdrop, that's the frame, that's the, you know, that's all part of the canvas of the painting, that's of the poem. And for me, there had to be that build up. We had to set the stage, you know. But when it got to that point of actually cutting the fruit, you can't go back. You can't make the apple whole again once you make that first slice.
Oh, that's good. That's good.
And
somebody who's going to die can eat an apple, though?
But that's just it. He couldn't. He wasn't supposed to.
But, I mean, did he actually ingest it?
Yes, he did. He did. He did. He did.
He went out happy.
He did.
That's a poet's job.
That's what Earl wanted. And, I mean, and he knew what he was doing when he gestured to me. You know, he wanted this apple, and he did it so slyly that no one else could see.
Oh, I love that. The last taste of the earth. Yeah, let's have another poem. Terry Ellen Cross.
And this poem is... this is called Nights at Maya's. You mentioned that I was a Poor Foundation Fellow right after the journalism. This was at Ohio University in Athens. I got involved into an international affairs and African studies graduate program. And part of that program involved me going on an internship to Kenya, to Nairobi. What was supposed to be 6 weeks turned into 3.5 months. And this is one of the many poems that came out of that experience. And this is called Nights at Maya's. As always, I arrive with the Scottish Mzungu. Eventually, his presence will stop getting us faster service. He starts by ordering Tusker, and we are armed with conversation on observations. Once, in their eyes, I was probably a prostitute. What black woman hangs with white men? So I told them, Mimi ni wanafunzi, I am a student, so don't give me those tisk-tisks. When I place my order, yama choma with goat, I know I saved a chicken's life because he escapes the pen in the back and comes out running to thank me. The servers don't know why I laugh. Because it is tradition, I wash my hands in the dirty bowl the little boy carries from table to table before cupping the steaming ugali and nyama choma to my lips like prayer. This is what I will remember from Kenya, not the woman around the corner with her fresh mangoes, brown eggs with feathers, fresh food my stomach will not process. Not the planned monthly riots with crimson-tainted rifle butts, the two-handed gropes and gaudy bars, but the long nights at Maya's, when I gave it all up for roasted goat stewed in onions, tomatoes, maybe some irio or chips on the side, and maize porridge for capturing all the juices, and just talk under the open, studded sky.
An American in Kenya. Mm-hmm. I hope we get a whole book out of that.
And see, it was being a Black American in Kenya.
That's quite a thing. A Black American in Africa. Mm-hmm. I have heard a lot of people give me their take on that. What's yours?
Mine was in many ways informed by that graduate experience, you know, spending all that time studying African history, African politics, learning Swahili.
You really did learn the language.
I spent 1 year, just one.
Was it so hard?
It was difficult because I'd learned Spanish from like seventh grade to my sophomore year of college. So layering, for me, it was difficult trying to layer Swahili over Spanish. And I kept thinking in Spanish first and then the Swahili. But after a while, I got it enough that I could kind of cruise through Kenya. And when I opened my mouth and spoke Swahili, people actually thought I was Kenyan and they would put me in tribes. So that was kind of funny. But it was really interesting because I think a lot of people have this, what we would call like a romantic Gloriana, idealized version of Africa. And they meld it all together instead of separating it out into little countries with their own cultures and so forth. And I came over without that, and I was able to shrug that off and see Kenya with a different side. And, you know, as a Black American, we're often looking for roots because we had to be wiped clean of those during slavery. And in that romantic Gloriana of Africa, there's that idea of wanting to make this connection to a continent that no longer remembers us. And as I told one person, it's like having a mother with Alzheimer's. I mean, she just... there's no connection there.
What a remark.
In terms of just a different culture. The culture that I most identify with, really, is being a Black American.
Well, you have said the one thing I've heard before, disappointment. Many wonderful things, but disappointment also. Mm-hmm. That is beautiful. A mother with Alzheimer's. Is that in part of your writing?
In one of the poems I have, I think. Gosh. I did say something like, it's like,
what
you
is
know,
that manuscript called?
Jilted is the name of the manuscript.
And that has got to come out. How many poems are about Kenya?
There's a nice thing, probably about maybe five or six.
You gave it all up for the roasted goat.
Yeah, you know. At Yama Choma, I was on this mefloquin stuff, and I just always wanted to eat, and oh, the food was so delicious.
Was it?
Oh, it was so delicious. That was probably the healthiest I've ever eaten, ever.
Even with washing your hands in the dirty water?
Even with washing my hands in the dirty water, because the food was not overly processed like we process food in America. You know, all my food was very, very fresh.
Would you go back?
I want to. I'd like to take my husband back, just because he's never been. And I think it would really be funny. And I use a word I should mention in that poem, Mzungu, which is Swahili for foreigner. And that's really what they would call many white people that they saw Mzungu. Was obviously, they're white, you know, for the most part, they weren't from Kenya. You know, so I would love to take my husband. I think he would love the food. He's a foodie himself.
What a treat. Terry Ellen Cross. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and I would love to hear more and more.
I will read. This is a longer poem, and this is one. It took a while to come together.
They are hard.
They are.
Not for the beginner.
No. And this is called Dear Diary, and this is actually based off of a true story, two true stories. I kind of combined them for the sake of the poem. I'm originally from Cleveland, Ohio, and this was covered in the Cleveland Plain Dealer, the paper there, in February of around 97, 98. Dear Diary, and it's written in like journal entries, so. May 96. He always be over after everybody go to work, when first period bell would be ringing if we was in school. I like him best out of all the boys. When he asked, mm-hmm. I let him put it in me. I figured I'd make him my boyfriend now. August 96. It's Friday. Grandma's frying fish. I dreamt about eating some, so I just can't get enough. Grandma is looking at me funny, but Mom is laughing, calling me her new garbage disposal. But I must be sick or something, because I keep throwing everything back up. October, 96. I'm getting fat, just a little, because I can't fit my favorite pair of jeans. My boyfriend be like, oh, it's all good since he like his women thick. Me, I'm his woman. I can't wait to see what he got me for my 13th birthday. January, 97. Mom's tripping. Keep asking me if I'm pregnant because I'm all fat and stuff. That woman just jealous because I got a man and she ain't been able to keep one since we moved in with grandma last year. March, 97. My stomach is killing me. I think I got gallstones or something, but I'm scared to say anything though. But this stuff feels like I'm gonna die or something. Turns out I was pregnant. I got a son now. I'm gonna name him Lachey. June, 97. My baby daddy live with us now. He ain't going to school no more. Besides, that teacher that got him arrested was tripping anyway. He's slanging, so we got fly clothes and everything, and he can ball. He keeps saying he going to the NBA. That would be the stuff. I hope it happens. August, 97. Lachey was acting funny, crying all night. I told my man to get him, because, man, I ain't got to do everything. He hit me and was like, oh, get up. I was like, boy, bunk that. I'm tired. That baby just probably fell off the couch or something. He'd be all right. Mama said I gotta let him cry. That I'd be spoiling him anyway, holding him all the time. Whatever. November, 97. Mom ain't gonna watch the baby tonight. Man, she'd be tripping. And grandma at church, so I gotta take him with me. Just came back from my girls. We smoked a Philly and chilled out. They all think Lachey is the cutest baby. He had on his Baby Gap outfit. I know I'm lucky to have a man like mine. It sucks sometimes, but I'm happy we live together. January, 98. Ninth grade is hard. Lachey don't cry as much at night, so at least I can sleep. March, 98. Yesterday, I picked up Lachey. His chest felt all soft and squishy. My cousin called 911. Ain't nobody know what happened to him, why he was like that. They just said he probably fell off the couch or something. By the time we got to the hospital, my son was dead. He was only 11 months old. Now he gone. April, 98. The police arrested Lachey's daddy today. Told me he killed the baby, that he beat him up and killed him. My brother said if they put him in jail, he can get one of his boys to shank him. When am I going to tell everybody at school?
Oh, Terry, what a poem. The body does not lie. I am just, the first line, I thought, oh, what a wonderful actor she is. And I started smiling. And then I just kept getting into the poem. And that is so powerful. Where are you going with that poem?
I was really happy to have this poem accepted to an anthology called Growing Up Girl. And it's done a lot of great work, and I was really happy to have it in that collection. This poem, it disturbed me.
It's so powerful. It is so powerful.
The Plain Dealer ran a full color picture of Lachey in the paper in his Baby Gap outfit, and just to think what that baby went through, and then to think, you know, you go through all the emotions as you read through the story, and you think, okay, I want to blame the children, but then they're children. What does a 13-year-old know about giving birth and being a mother, really? At this point, you know, we've moved to a point where 13-year-olds don't know about that. And I wanted to blame the parents, but the parents were, you know, younger than I am at this point.
It's beyond judgment. It is completely. That's why the poem is vindication in itself.
Yeah, I just.
We cannot get mad at anyone. So that's why you write the poem, because it certainly makes a case.
I like that
line, the ninth grade, the work, because it reminds us back, ninth grade,
yeah,
so young. And so I'm very glad that you brought us back to peg her where she belongs with that. And Lachey wasn't crying so much anymore. And you are really an actor, aren't you? Have you performed?
I was in the drama club in high school. That's about it.
That's not about it. Remember how we were saying that our blueprint was formed by what we did as little kids. Mm-hmm. The same things I played as a youngster, I am playing now as an adult.
And my Barbie was a writer. So that it all did come back together.
Her Barbie was a writer. There's another book title. This is who Terry Ellen is. She's been published many, many places in many anthologies, including Bum Rush, A Deaf Poetry Jam. Is it Bum Rush the Page?
Yes, Bum Rush the Page.
A Gathering Ground and Growing Up Girl. That's an anthology of female poets and MCs. She's been in Beltway Quarterly. I've read her work. And in Kaveh Khanum's anthologies. Did you know that Cornelius is getting a poem in the New Yorker?
I did hear that.
Yeah.
I did.
That Cornelius Edie was one of the founders of Kaveh Khanum. And she's in the Gargoyle, the new Gargoyle. Also, Poetic Voices Without Borders. What she does during the day is work very hard at the Folger Shakespeare Library. As the coordinator, I like to call it the director because it's a lot more trouble than coordinator, directs the lecture and poetry series at the Folger. So what one of your things is that you work with a group to choose who will read there?
Well,
or do you do it autonomously?
Autonomously, for the most part. There are two readings that I don't control, and that's the O.B. Hardison Jr. Poetry Prize. I work with the judges. The judges this year, Joshua Weiner, Sarah Kennedy, and Tom Slay, they selected David Wojahn as the 2007 O.B. Hardison Jr. Poetry Prize winner. And then the Folger Poetry Board, a great group of people who love and adore poetry, they select a Folger Poetry Board reader for the season, and this year the reader is Lucille Clifton. So that those two readings I don't control, but the rest I do have some.
As you have a nice background in poetry, you've paid your dues and you have earned your stripes. You have, from college on, you have been in the trenches working with poetry, broadcasting, performing, writing. And so that gave you a good look at the land, at the terrain.
I wanted to be an English major when I went into Ohio University. But, there's that practical side of my mother just saying, no, pick something where you can make some money, honey.
And that why I was a teacher instead of a ballet dancer? Or else I was just a klutz.
And so, yeah, so it was like I always, my minor was English. And I took so many creative writing courses in undergrad and grad. And then just to come to American and be able to do the program there, Henry Taylor actually talked me into it. After seeing me read at the Virginia Festival, the book in like 2000, he said, you know, you really should apply to American University. And I always thank him for that, you know, because it really was, it came together.
I think there's a lot of you come with it also. Mm-hmm. A lot of stuff just comes with. And then they can help put the icing on the cake. Terry Ellen Cross. I'm getting used to her middle name now. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress, and we're going to go on with her poetry.
This next poem is, in many ways, kind of, it has its origin in the real world, like any poem doesn't, but this is for Yvette Cady, who's a woman that I think people in the Washington, D.C. area may remember, and other women who felt, and it's called Wrath. First, I feel the wetness, sudden, spreading like shame, saturating my blouse, my skirt, my slip. The smell of gasoline washes over me like an overpowering cologne. I realize the origin, the Sprite bottle in my estranged husband's hand. I think, Roger, I will get to you in just a moment. I have a customer waiting. Then I hear the whir and click of the lighter, and heat leans into me for a kiss. Flame eats the air from his hand to my skirt, my blouse, my bra, flame eating its way to my face like a hungry lover's mouth. A new smell, at once familiar, unnerving, burning hair. Heat's breath is in my face. My face is melting, dripping into my hands. Now, as flames lick my ears, Roger opens his mouth. Woman, how pretty are you now?
Terry You took an expletive out of that.
Mm-hmm.
You can actually do that because that last line, let's hear that last line with the expletive.
The last
I know
line.
You were honoring the FCC, mm-hmm. and we thank you for that. But that last line is significant.
Yeah, I
go
I
ahead.
Felt that way too. The last line is, bitch, how pretty are you now?
So we gave a disclaimer already.
Mm-hmm.
That's important.
Yes.
I think that's very important, that last line. And so how you deal with the world, the vicissitudes and the horrible stuff, is that you process it by writing poetry.
I internalize a lot of it. And a lot of it, you know, as I tell people, so much in the world hurts my feelings, you know.
Oh.
And so it's like, you know, you read it and you want to know, where do I go with all this emotion? Where do I go with Lachey and baby Lachey and seeing these pictures? And where do I go with hearing the story of Yvette Cady? I mean, she went on Oprah. She went, you know, everyone knows the story of how her husband burnt her. And she's not the only one. You know, there have been so many other women. You can talk about stoning. You can talk about female genital mutilation. You can talk about so many different ways in which our society decides that the woman must bear the brunt. What does Zora Neale Hurston say? You know, women are the mules of the world. We bear so much of the anger and animosity that comes out, the malevolence. It just gets directed and funneled toward women. And I just think, you know, we really need a voice of that.
You can't
poetry.
Make a better contribution in this world.
You
cannot make a better voice in this world than what you're doing. And that's what you were put on earth to do.
Sometimes I think I feel like it wouldn't touch me so if I weren't meant to write about it. And so that's what I
that's
trust.
The price you pay.
Yeah.
I told you that a wonderful quote I had read of C.K. Williams, who mentioned the poet has the curiosity of the ethnographer, the precision of the philosopher, and the scrupulousness of the scientist. May I give you that award? And let's hear another poem.
Thank you. I'm going to switch things up. This is a poem it's called At 5 Weeks, and it has an epigraph from a singer, Terence Trent D'Arby, in the song Seasons, and this is the epigraph. Or epithang, as Lucille Clifton calls it.
Yes,
epithang. It's all right for a season, but then it's time to change. Like a splinter, the bleeding didn't last long. A day, two at the most, when the pain pricked, then pricked again, businesslike, curt. A miscarriage leaves no genetic calling card like a live birth. No grooves where the pelvic bone popped apart. No finger painting the genes to say, someone was here. Memory sharpens the pain, splintering its lightning through the body. The body, its grieving heart, its hunger, its questioning. Can we not have joy last past the season? There was no warning this muscular embrace would break. No warning the bow would fall. The blood would flee in mutiny, spreading down the thighs, forsaking. I have found if I turn my head this way and see that perfect tendril of February sun, the memory of pain comes back. If I listen to the singer's tenor breaking sorrows back, the straining violin too full of beauty to sustain, I return to the moment when I was but brief the vessel, and I am the vessel again, slowly emptying myself of you.
How does the mind work? I don't even know, except that we just will know by listening to another one. Carrie Ellen Cross.
I am one of the, I've had the oddest muse, I think alive, I think. and that is, I had a big crush on the actor Adrian Brody. And I kept thinking, you know, oh, this guy's so great. A lot of people remember him from winning the Oscar, I think it was 2003, for The Pianist. And then also they remember him for the backbreaking kiss he gave Halle Berry, who was presenting him the award. And I've just, you know, doing a lot of reading and reading Us Weekly. I will admit to that. this poem came
just
from
in
me.
The grocery store, standing in line, right?
yeah, we'll say that. But this poem is called The Blonde on His Arm after reading Us Weekly. There's no comparing to her lithe figure. Wonder if she works out all day, if he pays for her trainer, if she even has a job. Then she is blonde, which is a different category than white. Blonde has its own story, its own golden fabric of myth. Add blonde to white, and automatically he is out of my league. Always, no matter how much I scrub in the morning showers, the dark patches on elbows and knees won't go away. Only red replaces them. Raw, after disgust, has its turn. Black is my soul, they say. Black is my skin, they say. Brown is my skin, I say. And the only color my soul knows is longing, the weight of its opaque density.
Dynamite. Dynamite, dynamite. I asked you, what did you leave out of a poem? And I will answer, nothing. Let's have a final poem.
This was the very first poem that I had published. And it came from D.C., so I think it, you know, fitting. And of course, make sure I can find it.
But we're global, you know.
Yeah, I know. And
you just push that button and we're in Hong Kong.
I know. And I think that the interesting thing, and this I'll just say this, I'll just read it. It's called Complected, and this was in Bum Rush the Page, the Deaf Poetry Jam anthology. What the fine rain does not hide and cannot wash away are cold fingers shrugging slicker strings tighter, protecting just straightened hair. The humidity is deadly to this delicate process and can nap the nape along the kitchen instantly, reverting to the natural curl she dreads. The girl beside her wears no slicker, but has a ponytail like Barbie's and is just as fair. The pubescent boys stare. She's an urban Venus and possibly waiting for the same bus. The hooded girl is not Venus. Dark brown is not beauty. Darker still, a death sentence if you are young, waiting for a bus, a long appreciative glance, even catcalls. Hey, Redbone, love. The hooded girl hopes the Korean store up the street will have a sale soon on fading cream and human hair, because beauty here is serious business.
May I remind you of a line of your own, now the real work begins. This is Terry Ellen Cross. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. Our guest has been Terry Ellen Cross. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for its support and assistance. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. Our associate producer is Ken Flynn. Post-production is by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. This program is funded by the Witter Binner Foundation for Poetry.